Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended with Indian classical and Western music. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and it's truly an honor to accompany you on this journey of discovering the rich interweaving of music and history. Together, we will go on a journey, but for today, I have a more... How do I put it? A very contemporary and pop and essentially Punjabi music. Well, Punjab is a state of India, just like we have provinces here in Canada. India, we have states, and one of the states is Punjab. That's very close to my heart, and Punjabi music is, well, you'll see, it is energetic, it is enthusiastic, and it is amazing. So I'm very looking forward to you all listening to this music and enjoying it. First up, I have this song called Admiring You by Karan Aujla. He's a Canadian artist, but he sings in Punjabi. Hopefully you guys will understand a little bit of it. And if you don't, just enjoy the rhythm. Let's do this.
बैठो गल करिए प्यार दी आज काली काली रात मार दी देखो तारिया दिलो हाथ ता फड़ो कदे नी छड़दा यार नी तेरे तू दो जान वार नी तुसी हुक्म करो कदे मिलके बैठो गल करिए प्यार दी आज काली काली रात मार दी देखो तारिया दिलो नी तेनू देख के जी लगदा देख दीवा जगदा नी तेनू देख के ता लगदा तू मोरा कोलो सिख दी तोरा दस की चौनी है जान सुखानी है नी तू जद वाल सुखानी है फिर सुलफे वांगू चढ़ दियां लोरा जो कहेगी जट कर जुगोरिए तू माता चंगा सर जुगोरिए तुसी एवें ना डरो कदे मिलके बैठो गल करिए प्यार दी आज काली काली रात मार दी देखो तारिया दिलो हाथ ता फड़ो कदे नी छड़दा यार नी तेरी तू दो जान वार नी तुसी हुक्म करो कदे मिलके बैठो
All it took was a single glance. Yeah, it's true, girl, I love you bad. Ooh, baby, got your hands on me. I get so dirty, but you look so clean. I just wanna show you what I'm gonna do when it's just me and you. I could be your lifeline, you know I wanna make you mine. I'll never let you go. So baby, take a chance, just grab my hand. Show you a life full of romance. If you're ready, we can go.
कदे मिलके बैठो गल करिए प्यार दी आज काली काली रात मार दी देखो तारिया दिलो हाथ ता फड़ो कदे नी छड़दा यार नी तेरे तो दो जान वार नी तुसी हुक्म करो नी टोरा कटदी रहनी है हसदी रहनी है नी तू जो सजदी रहनी है और की दिली मेरे करके नजर मिला ली मैं ऐनक ला ली मैं यादे गानी पा ली मैं और की दिली तेरे करके सो आले हाथ फड़ ला यार दा नी ओजले नू पाला मार दा नेड़े तो नेड़े हो कदे मिलके बैठो गल करिए प्यार दी आज काली काली रात मार दी देखो तारिया दिलो हाथ ता फड़ो कदे नी छड़दा यार नी तेरे तो दो जान वार नी तुसी हुक्म करो
And I'll never let you go
Thank you. ਕੇ ਕਰੇ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਸ਼ਾਂ ਪਤਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੇ ਦੇਗਾ ਤੂੰ ਜਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਜਿਵੇਂ ਤੂੰ ਜੱਟਾ ਵੇ ਹਟਾਉਂਦਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਜਿਵੇਂ ਤੂੰ ਹੱਥਾਂ ਨਾ ਖਵਾਉਂਦਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਸੀ ਜੇ ਉਹ ਮਾਂ ਮੈਂ ਬਣਾਉਂਦਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤਾਂ ਹੀ ਤਾਂ ਇੰਨਾ ਪਿਆਰ ਆਉਂਦਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਹੱਕ ਨਾ ਪੜੇ ਤੂੰ ਮੇਰੀ ਬਾਂ ਕਿੰਨਾ ਸੋਹਣਾ ਲੈਂਦਾ ਮੇਰਾ ਨਾਂ ਪਤਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੇ ਦੇਗਾ ਤੂੰ ਜਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਜਿਵੇਂ ਤੂੰ ਅੱਖਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਮਿਲਾਈ ਜਾਣਾ ਨਸ਼ਾ ਜਾ ਚੜਾਈ ਜਾਣਾ ਜਿਵੇਂ ਤੂੰ ਮੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਲੰਘਾਈ ਜਾਣਾ ਨੇੜੇ ਤੋਂ ਨੇੜੇ ਹੋ ਰਿਹਾਈ ਜਾਣਾ ਕਿੰਨਾ ਤੰਗ ਕਰਦੀਆਂ ਹਾਂ ਤੇਓੜੀ ਨੀ ਜਮਾਂ ਪਤਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੇ ਦੇਗਾ ਤੂੰ ਜਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਖਿੜ ਹੱਸਦੀ ਨਜ਼ਰ ਲੱਗ ਜੂ ਖੁਸ਼ੀ ਨੀ ਰਹਿਣੀ ਆ ਕੋਈ ਗਮੀ ਲੱਭਦੇ ਸ਼ਕਲੋਂ ਦਿਲੋਂ ਤੂੰ ਇੰਨਾ ਸਾਫ ਸੂਰਤ ਐਵੇਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਕੋਈ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਚ ਜੱਟਾ ਕਮੀ ਲੱਭਦੇ ਜਿਵੇਂ ਤੂੰ ਸਜੀ ਨੂੰ ਸਜਾਉਂਦਾ ਰਹਿਣਾ ਜਿਵੇਂ ਤੂੰ ਖਿਜੀ ਨੂੰ ਖਜਾਉਂਦਾ ਰਹਿਣਾ ਮੇਰੇ ਤੇ ਗੀਤਾਂ ਨੂੰ ਬਣਾਉਂਦਾ ਰਹਿਣਾ ਮੇਰੇ ਤੇ ਲਿਖੇ ਹੋਏ ਸੁਣਾਉਂਦਾ ਰਹਿਣਾ ਆਓ ਜਲੇ ਤੇਰੇ ਤੇ ਮਰ ਜਾ ਮੇਰੇ ਤੇ ਬਣਾਉਣਾ ਤਰ ਜਾ ਪਤਾ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੇ ਦੇਗਾ ਤੂੰ ਜਾ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ ਤਾਂ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਤੇਰੇ ਨਾਲ ਪਿਆਰ ਜੱਟਾ
All right, guys. Now let's take a break from the Punjabi pop music and move on to our short story of the week, of the day. All right, let's dive into it. Justin moved to Canada with a dream of fame. He moved with a suitcase that smelled like home and a playlist that refused to stay quiet. Back in Brampton, everyone had a cousin who knew someone in the scene. Someone who had a studio in their basement. Someone who shot videos behind an industrial plaza because the brick looked cinematic at night. Someone who could make a hook in 10 minutes and turn it into a sound that traveled further than any bus route ever could. Jazz was 16 when he realized Punjabi music in Canada wasn't just music. It was navigation. It told you where to buy the best samosas after school, which banquet halls booked the loudest DJs, which parks had cricket games that always turned into impromptu dance circles, which streets felt like you could walk in your own skin without translating yourself. On the days when school felt like a room built for someone else's voice, Jazz would put on his headphones and let Punjabi fill the gaps. Not as escape, exactly, more like an armor, more like a reminder that his name did not need to soften to be accepted. His mom called it noise, his dad called it energy, his grandmother, Nani, called it too much bass. Jazz called it truth. He wrote lyrics on the Notes app like he was leaving messages to himself. Mostly short lines, half-formed hooks, words that sounded better when they were said out loud. Dil, Zid, Rah, Sheher. Some days his lines were confident like they had shoulders. Other days they were shaky like he wasn't sure he deserved to take up space. Still, he kept on writing. Then one Thursday after school, he got a DM from a guy named Karan who had a small following and a bigger attitude. Yo, heard you can write. Pull up to the studio tonight. Bring 16 bars. Jazz stared at the message for a full minute, convinced it was a prank. In Brampton, opportunities rarely came with this formal invitation. They arrived like a bass drop, sudden, loud, and dangerous. He typed back, "Where?" And Karen sent a location pin and one more text. "Don't be late. We're not doing poetry hour." At home, Jazz told his mom he had a group project. She gave him the look she saved for lies that tried too hard. But she didn't stop him. She just slid a container of piranhas into his backpack like she was feeding both his stomach and his courage. Outside, the air was cold enough to make the streetlights look sharper. Jazz took the bus, then another bus, then walked past a strip mall that smelled like pizza and exhaust. The studio was in a townhouse basement, the kind of place you'd never notice unless you already knew where to look. He knocked. The door opened to a wall of sound. Not a finished track, something half-built. A kick drum testing its own weight. A whole sample looping like a heartbeat. A voice in the background saying, run it again, like repetition could force perfection. Karen stood in the doorway with a hoodie pulled tight and eyes that measured people quickly. "You're the kid?" he asked. Jazz nodded, suddenly aware of how young his face looked in fluorescent basement light. Karen stepped aside. "Come." Inside, the room was smaller than Jazz expected. Two monitors, a cheap mic with a pop filter, LED lights stuck along the ceiling like they were just trying to turn the basement into a spaceship. Posters on the wall, some of artists Jazz recognized, some of local names that lived mostly on Instagram and word of mouth. Two other guys were there, one hunched over a laptop, fingers moving fast, and another leaning back with a phone in his hand, scrolling like he was bored of everything. I mean, doom scrolling is so real, am I right? "Beat's almost ready," the producer said without looking up. "We need a hook." Karen pointed at Jazz. "He's got the bars," and the bored guy looked up and smirked. "He got bars or he got captions?" Anyway, Jazz felt his heart raise in his neck. The room wasn't hostile exactly, but it wasn't gentle either. In this scene, you earned softness later. First, you proved you belonged. Karen tossed him a pair of headphones. "Let's hear what you got." The beat started. It was heavy, clean, modern. The kind of sound that made you picture a highway at night, taillights stretching into the distance. Underneath, a faint Punjabi folk texture like a bat dumbi line ghosting the edges, not long enough to be obvious but present enough to feel. Jazz's mouth went dry. I don't blame him. He had written his words on the bus, rewriting the same two lines again and again until they felt sharp enough. But now, standing in front of the mic, he realized something. Writing was safe because it stayed inside you. Recording was different. Recording meant that your voice became public property. The producer paused the track. He said, "Are you good?" Jazz nodded too fast. "Yeah." Karen leaned in, not unkindly. "Don't overthink it. Just say it," he said. "Just say it." As if voice was that simple. Jazz closed his eyes and started. The first line came out thin. Not wrong, but not exactly strong either. It was afraid of the room. The second line improved. The third line found its footing. And by the fourth line, his voice stopped asking for permission. He didn't rap like he was trying to sound like someone else. He rapped like he was himself. Punjabi consonant, Brampton vowels, English slipping in where it felt natural, not forced. Halfway through, the bored guy stopped scrolling on Instagram. By the end, the producer nodded slowly. "Okay," he said, as if he didn't want to admit he was impressed. "Okay." Karen didn't smile. He just said, "Run it again. Louder." And Jazz did. This time, his voice hit the beat like it belonged there, like the bass had been waiting for him. When he finished, there was a moment of quiet that felt bigger than the basement. Then Karen finally grinned. "See? You weren't gonna die." And the bored guy shrugged, but it wasn't dismissive anymore. "Not bad, little bro." Jazz exhaled, laughing softly because he hadn't realized he'd been holding his breath. The producer looped a section. "Hook next. Karen, you got something?" Garn tried a line, but it sounded too predictable, like a phrase designed for comments rather than meaning. He stopped and frowned. Jazz hesitated, but then eventually spoke. He said, "I have an idea," and everybody turned. His heart kicked hard against his ribs. He wasn't sure if he was allowed to suggest anything, but he remembered his own rule, the one he had made quietly in his head long before he ever entered this basement. He said, "If you're going to take up space, do it honestly." He said the hook he'd been saving, simple, melodic, and rooted in something older than the beat. A line his grandmother, Nani, used to say when Jazz was anxious, trying to rush through life. She used to say, "Sabr kar putter," which translates to "be patient, my son." He sang it once, then again, letting the rhythm carry it. Not fancy, just the truth. The producer's eyes widened slightly. "That's it. That's literally it," he said, almost surprised. "That's the hook." Karan tilted his head. "Sabr," he repeated, tasting the word like he was hearing it properly for the first time. "Man, that's hard." Jazz swallowed. "Yeah, because everyone's always in a hurry here." The board guy nodded. "Facts." They recorded the hook, then again layered one take higher, one take lower, harmonies that made the Punjabi word felt like it belonged in the same world as the 808s, which is the type of drum kit, not as a cultural touch, but as the center. When they played it back, the room changed. The track wasn't finished, but it had a spine now. It stood up straight. For a second, Jazz imagined it on someone else's headphones. On the bus, in a gym, in a car on the 401, windows down despite the cold because the music was too alive to contain. He felt a rush of pride and fear tangled together. Karan slapped his shoulder. "You got a name? Like artist name?" "Yeah," Karan said. "We're not putting Jazz from grade 11 on Spotify." Jazz laughed, then paused. He thought about names before. He tried a few in his head, all of them sounding fake at the moment he said them. And he said, "I want to use my real name. Bold." I'm tired of shrinking it," Jazz nodded. No one argued, and later when he left the basement, the air outside felt warmer but lighter. Jazz walked to the bus stop with the Paranta container still in his bag, untouched. He felt oddly grateful for it anyway. And on the ride home, he watched the city through the window. He didn't need his headphones right now, because the hook was still in his chest. "Sabr kar putter, be patient, son." And Jazz realized something he hadn't known before tonight. Punjabi music in Canada wasn't just bass and bravado. It was memory with drums. It was language refusing to disappear. It was kids like him building stages in basements and parking lots, not because it was easy, but because it was theirs. And the bus turned onto the highway. The city lights stretched out, long and endless. Jazz leaned his head against the glass and smiled. Small, private, certain. Not because he'd made it, but because, for the first time, he felt like he could.
Tickets are on sale now for Side by Side Union Gallery's annual major fundraiser. Join them on Saturday, February 7th for an evening of live music, artsy activities, and a lottery-style draw where everyone is a winner. Take home a one-of-a-kind artwork and support Union Gallery's nonprofit mission. Come visit the exhibition or check out the online catalog to see the 100-plus works available. Head to uniongallery.ca and get your ticket for Side by Side today.
Alright guys, before I play the next song, I kind of want to introduce it. It's called Human, and it was produced, written, composed, performed, and everything by yours truly, Simmer. And I'm just so excited to play it for you guys, and I hope you all like it. And if you do, please reach out to my Instagram at core, K-A-U-R-X, Simmer, S-I-M-A-R. Well, to give a little feedback, or I would just love to talk about it because this song is very close to my heart. So without further ado, here goes Human by Simmer Kaur.
Tried to give reason, I followed my demons, but I
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM are turning up the heat this winter with a stacked lineup of shows. At the Broom Factory, don't miss out on Metal Fusion cellist extraordinaire Raphael Byrath Brown on January 23rd. On February 14th, you can see local rockers Cassador take the stage, while Canadian punk rockers The Flatliners are live on February 20th. And don't miss out on Daniel Romano's Outfit on March 13th, followed by Schoolhouse and Brady Man on March 15th. And the winter season rounds up with the Sheepdogs live at Kingston Grand Theater on March 16th. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
The eye of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life. without the other two.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. U.S. top court hears trans student sports ban cases, Malaysian authorities shut down empty gay-friendly hotel, and Isherwood's own stories of pre-war Berlin. All that and more this week, now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Nico Raquel.
With NewsRound. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 17th, 2026. Can transgender athletes be banned from competing in U.S. government-funded school athletic programs? The United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments on January 13th in two cases that test the constitutionality of such bans. Their decision will touch virtually every public school or university because they all depend on some type of federal funding to cover operating costs. In the case of Little versus Hecox, 25-year-old Lindsay Hecox filed suit after Boise State University in Idaho rejected her efforts to try out for the women's track and cross-country teams. 15-year-old shot putter and discus thrower Becky Pepper Jackson is the plaintiff in West Virginia versus BPJ. Both states are challenging lower court rulings that supported the trans athletes. The cases zero in on the meaning of bias based on sex in the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and the sex-based bias in education banned in Title IX of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Opponents of trans participation insist that trans females have a physical advantage over cisgender females because they were born with male physical dominance. Their claim lacks scientific evidence. Any such advantage is likely erased by gender-affirming care such as puberty blockers and hormone therapies. The High Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act bans bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity in the workplace in the landmark Bostock versus Clayton County decision of 2020. Voting with a majority in that case, Chief Justice John Roberts wanted aloud if Bostock extends to school athletics. Based on the justices' questions and comments during the oral arguments, court watchers generally speculate that the conservative majority will support the trans bans. The Supreme Court's ruling is expected sometime in June. 27 of the 50 U.S. states specifically ban trans girls and women from competing in school sports. Trans boys and men are not affected.
As they deliberate on the pending trans student athlete cases, the U.S. Supreme Court might do well to consider a recent Journal of Pediatrics study. It confirms that trans young people who have access to gender-affirming hormone replacement therapies are demonstrably less suicidal. Researchers surveyed 432 patients aged 12 to 20 over 679 days. They found that suicidality significantly declined from pre-treatment to post-treatment, regardless of the respondents' gender, age, and duration of treatment. The authors say their findings provide clinical evidence supporting the mental health benefits of timely access to hormone therapies in this population. This latest research supports the positions of major medical groups in the United States. The American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry all say that gender-affirming healthcare is evidence-based and medically necessary for both trans adults and minors. The World Health Organization and the World Medical Association concur. Another mental health study was reported in December by the Trevor Project, a queer youth suicide prevention organization. It discovered that trans and non-binary young people aged 13 to 24 were 31% less likely to contemplate or try to kill themselves in the past year if their chosen pronouns are respected.
A Malaysian hotel advertised as gay-friendly on social media is now closed by order of the unfriendly authorities. The State of Malacca Religious Affairs Department and officers from the local Bachang Municipal Council raided the 37-room hotel on January 13th. No guests were found, and an unmade bed with two used condoms nearby in one room were the only signs of activity. No one who had booked the room could be found, according to the local reports. The municipal council nevertheless revoked the hotel's operating license and demanded that its owner explain the gay-friendly characterization on its website. In predominantly Muslim Malaysia, same-gender sex is punishable by up to 3 years in prison. That's in secular court. A religious court can sentence offenders with hefty fines and public whippings. Malaysia's anti-LGBTQ crackdown has been escalating over the past few years. 203 men were detained in a raid on an alleged gay sauna in the capital of Kuala Lumpur just last month.
The second term of President Donald Trump's administration is driving some U.S. LGBTQ people back into the closet. Almost 1 in 2 respondents to the Human Rights Campaign Foundation's annual LGBTQ plus community survey say they are now being less out somewhere in their lives. The organization polled more than 14,000 people across the country, two-thirds of whom identify as LGBTQ plus. Nearly 1 in 3 of the LGBTQ plus people surveyed think social acceptance of queer people has diminished since the new administration took power. Bias and stigma in the workplace have also been reported in the last year by 57% of LGBTQ plus adults. Many of them blame the dismantling of their employer's diversity, equity, and inclusion programs due to the Trump administration's war on woke. Two-thirds of trans and non-binary adults said the administration's policies have made it more difficult for them to access health care. Queer people were also almost twice as likely as their heterosexual counterparts to say that their economic situation has worsened since Trump's January 2025 inauguration. Human Rights Campaign President Kelly Robinson discussed the report on MS Now's Morning Joe and issued a written statement that reads in part, "For all the pain Trump has caused, the LGBTQ plus community's resilience drives our power. Together, we continue to fight for a future in which everyone has the freedom to be who they are."
Finally, Trevor Project CEO James Black told the Associated Press, "I actually gasped." Their organization is getting a whopping $45 million donation from Mackenzie Scott, the billionaire philanthropist former wife of Amazon's Jeff Bezos. It's the largest single donation the 28-year-old life-saving queer youth organization has ever received. It comes at a time when the Trump administration's slashing of federal funding has all but shut down other queer youth crisis intervention groups. Scott donated $6 million to the group in 2020. CEO Black celebrated the new contribution, saying, "This historic donation from Mackenzie Scott comes at a time when the Trevor Project has never needed it more." LGBTQ plus youth in the U.S. are facing a growing mental health crisis, and the resources they have for support continue to be politicized and jeopardized. This gift provides a safety net for our life-saving suicide prevention and crisis intervention work, offering stability during a period of immense economic and political uncertainty. The $45 million is to be strategically invested to ensure the group's long-term financial stability. Black declared, "Thanks to Mackenzie Scott's extraordinary generosity, we are well positioned to continue working toward a world where every LGBTQ plus young person feels safe, seen, and supported exactly as they are."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending January 17th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Teixeira, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Nico Raquel. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Renee Nicole Good was murdered by a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Minneapolis, Minnesota on January 7th. Good was protesting ICE raids in her community, and her killing has intensified the worldwide movement against the Trump administration's attacks on immigrants. Except for the Justice Department's effort to prosecute Becca Good, Renee's spouse and family have been largely lost in the mainstream media din. Gay USA's Ann Northrup and Andy Hum aim to correct that omission.
The right wing and a lot of the world have refused to acknowledge that this was a loving couple and co-parents of this six-year-old boy.
I'll say something else. I mean, in the beginning, some right-wing people were like, this looks out of line, you know? And then when they heard she was a lesbian, they dumped her.
Renee had been married first to a guy with whom she had two kids who are now teenagers and are living with him in Colorado, where they came from.
And he speaks very highly of her.
Very, very. Clearly, they had a good relationship. And then they divorced, I guess. She remarried a guy who is the father of the now six-year-old son. He died, that father. And so now that Renee has been murdered, people are referring to the son, the six-year-old, as an orphan. Well, he's not an orphan. He has a stepmother in Becca, who has been his co-parent, his other mother, for some years now. And as she says in her statement, she will be raising him. So to refer to him as an orphan, technically, he's lost his birth parents, but he is not an orphan. He has her, he has grandparents, and who knows how many other relatives. And the erasure of this family as a loving whole is just another horrible chapter in this story.
That was Gay USA co-hosts Ann Northrup and Andy Hum on the life and death of ICE murder victim Renee Nicole Good.
I'm John Ritchie, author of City of Night, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I hope that you do stay tuned.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
While the world looks on with dismay as the U.S. government employs Gestapo tactics within its borders and imperialist threats abroad, This Way Out's Brian DeShazer is reminded of one of the great gay authors of the 20th century who lived through times like these.
Christopher Isherwood was born in England in 1904, came to the U.S. in 1939, and lived in Santa Monica from then until his death in 1986. His literary career began in 1928 with the publication of his first novel, All the Conspirators, and he's probably best known for the Berlin stories, stories that fictionalized his life in pre-World War II Berlin and that were adapted as the stage play I Am a Camera and the popular musical Cabaret. And now let's listen to Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin.
The Last of Mr. Norris is a book which describes a single character, Mr. Norris, who is a sort of gentlemanly crook, essentially a small-time crook, who is dabbling rather dangerously in deep waters. He plays around a little with espionage, with the communists, with various forces which are a great deal too big for him. He is by temperament a character who is much happier with a little modest blackmail and the arrangement of deals. This character is presented as a sympathetic character, and many have found him so, although, as one critic once said, he has not one single redeeming feature. The I of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life without the other two. William goes to see him, at his suggestion, in Berlin. And this is a description of William's first visit to Mr. Norris's apartment. Mr. Norris had two front doors to his flat. They stood side by side. Both had peepholes in the center and brightly polished knobs and brass nameplates. On the left-hand plate was engraved Arthur Norris, Private, and on the right hand, Arthur Norris, Export and Import. After a moment's hesitation, I pressed the button of the left-hand bell. The bell was startlingly loud. It must have been clearly audible all over the flat. Nevertheless, nothing happened. No sound came from within. I was just about to ring again when I became aware that an eye was regarding me through the peephole in the door. How long it had been there, I didn't know. I felt embarrassed and uncertain whether to stare the eye out of its hole or merely pretend that I hadn't seen it. I examined the ceiling, the floor, the walls, then ventured a furtive glance to make sure that it had gone. It hadn't. Vexed, I turned my back on the door altogether. Nearly a minute passed. When finally I did turn around, it was because the other door, the export and import door, had opened, and a young man stood on the threshold. "Is Mr. Norris in?" I asked. The young man eyed me suspiciously. He had watery, light yellow eyes and a blotched complexion the colour of porridge. His head was huge and round, set awkwardly on a short, plump body. He wore a smart lounge suit and patent leather shoes. I didn't like the look of him at all. "Have you an appointment?" "Yes." My tone was extremely curt. At once the young man's face curved into oily smiles. "Oh, it's Mr. Bradshaw. One moment, if you please." My astonishment, he closed the door in my face, only to reappear an instant later at the left-hand door, standing aside for me to enter the flat. This behaviour seemed all the more extraordinary because, as I noticed immediately I was inside, the private side of the entrance hall was divided from the export side only by a thick hanging curtain. "Mr. Norris wishes me to say that he will be with you in one moment," said the big-headed young man, treading delicately across the thick carpet on the toes of his patent leather shoes. He spoke very softly, as if he were afraid of being overheard. Opening the door of a large sitting room, he silently motioned me to take a chair and withdrew. Left alone, I looked around me, slightly mystified. Everything was in good taste, the carpet, the colour scheme, but the room was curiously without character. It was like a room on the stage or in the window of a high-class furnishing store. Elegant, expensive, discreet. I had expected Mr. Norris's background to be altogether more exotic. Something Chinese would have suited him, with golden and scarlet dragons. The young man had left the door ajar. The gentleman is here, sir. And now, with even greater distinctness, Mr. Norris's voice was audible as he replied from behind a door in the opposite wall of the sitting room. Oh, Izzy, thank you. I wanted to laugh. This little comedy was so unnecessary, it seemed slightly sinister. A moment later, Mr. Norris himself came into the room, nervously rubbing his manicured hands together. My dear boy, this is indeed an honor. Delighted to welcome you under the shadow of my humble roof tree. He didn't look well, I thought. His face wasn't so rosy today, and there were rings under his eyes. He sat down for a moment in an armchair, but rose again immediately, as if he were not in the mood for sitting still. The rest of this book describes how William gradually became involved with Mr. Norris and his plots and plans, and in the end, very nearly got into some extremely melodramatic trouble. The book is basically melodramatic, perhaps one should say a kind of melodramatic political farce. My second book about Berlin, Goodbye to Berlin, is altogether more serious in its basic intention, although it contains a number of comic figures. The best known of these is the girl called Sally Bowles, and her story was dramatized by John Van Druten, my great friend, now dead, to make a play called I Am a Camera, the title being a quotation from a passage in this book. I'll read you now a description of my first meeting with Sally Bowles from Goodbye to Berlin. One afternoon early in October, I was invited to black coffee at Fritz Wendell's flat. Fritz always invited you to black coffee, with emphasis on the black. He was very proud of his coffee. People used to say that it was the strongest in Berlin. Fritz himself was dressed in his usual coffee party costume, a very thick white yachting sweater and very light blue flannel trousers. He greeted me with his full-lipped, luscious smile. "Hello, Chris." "Hello, Fritz. How are you?" "Fine." He bent over the coffee machine, his sleek black hair unplastering itself from his scalp and falling in richly scented locks over his eyes. "This darn thing doesn't go," he added. "How's business?" I asked. "Lousy and terrible," Fritz grinned richly. "Or I pull off a new deal in the next month, or I go as a gigolo." "Either or," I corrected, from force of professional habit. "I'm speaking a lousy English just now," drawled Fritz with great self-satisfaction. "Sally says maybe she'll give me a few lessons." "Who's Sally?" "Why, I forgot you don't know Sally. Too bad of me. Eventually she's coming around here this afternoon." "Is she nice?" Fritz rolled his naughty black eyes, handing me a rum-moistened cigarette from his patent tin. "Marvelous," he drawled. "Eventually, I believe I'm getting crazy about her. Oh, who is she? What does she do?" "She's an English girl, an actress. Sings at the Lady Windermere. Hot stuff, believe me." A few minutes later, Sally herself arrived. "Am I terribly late, Fritz, darling?" "Only half of an hour, I suppose," Fritz drawled, beaming with proprietary pleasure. "May I introduce Mr. Isherwood, Miss Bowles?" "Mr. Isherwood is commonly known as Chris." "I'm not," I said. "Fritz is about the only person who's ever called me Chris in my life." "Do you mind if I use your telephone, sweet?" "Sure, go ahead." Fritz caught my eye, Come into the other room, Chris. I want to show you something. He was evidently longing to hear my first impressions of Sally, his new acquisition. For heaven's sake, don't leave me alone with this man, she exclaimed, or he'll seduce me down the telephone. He's most terribly passionate. As she dialed the number, I noticed that her fingernails were painted emerald green, a colour unfortunately chosen, for it called attention to her hands, which were much stained by cigarette smoking and as dirty as a little girl's. She was dark enough to be Fritz's sister. Her face was long and thin, powdered white. She had very large brown eyes, which should have been darker, to match her hair and the pencil she used for her eyebrows. "Hilloo," she cooed, pursing her brilliant cherry lips as though she were going to kiss the mouthpiece. "Is das du mein Liebling?" Her voice opened in a fatuously sweet smile. Fritz and I sat watching her like a performance at the theatre. "Was wollen wir machen?" Morgan abend. "Oh, wie wunderbar! Nein, nein, ich werde bleiben heute Abend zu Hause. Ja, ja, ich werde wirklich bleiben zu Hause. Auf Wiedersehen, mein Liebling." She hung up the receiver and turned to us triumphantly. "That's the man I slept with last night," she announced. "He makes love marvelously. He's an absolute genius at business, and he's terribly rich." She came and sat down on the sofa beside Fritz, sinking back into the cushions with a sigh. "Give me some coffee, will you, darling? I'm simply dying of thirst." And soon we were on to Fritz's favourite topic, love. He pronounced it larve.
You've been listening to iconic gay author Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Michael Taylor Gray and Nico Raquel. NewsWrap producer Brian DeShazer also provided this week's Christopher Isherwood feature, with thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives. Our thanks also to Ann Northrup and Andy Hum at GayUSATV.com. You heard music by Jethro Tull, Joel Gray, and Bronski Beat. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Brad Furr of KGAY Palm Springs, California, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WRFI Ithaca, New York, 4BI Fortitude Valley, Queensland, KCEI Taos, New Mexico, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this